Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Cranberries are a Thanksgiving staple. They're also a billion-dollar industry in Massachusetts, employing nearly 7,000 people. But the market is getting crowded. For years, the top grower in North America has actually been Wisconsin, where cranberry farms go back to the 1800s. Quebec has only been growing cranberries for the last 20 years, but it surpassed Massachusetts in its cranberry harvest in 2014. Growers in Massachusetts have a longtime ally at their side. The Cranberry Experiment Station in Wareham was founded in 1910 to keep cranberries viable economically. It's part of UMass Amherst, even though it's here on the coast. Carolyn de Moranville has been at the Cranberry Station for 33 years. She's the station director and an associate professor. Carolyn, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you.
Now, Thanksgiving may be the only day of the year that a lot of Americans have cranberries kind of right there on the dinner table. There's always cranberry juice or craisins around. But how important is Thanksgiving in an economic sense to cranberry growers?
In an economic sense, it is pretty huge. Certainly for the fresh market cranberry growers, this is the time of year that the berries have just been harvested, and this is when most of the fresh cranberries are sold into the holiday market.
Now, if we go back, you know, to maybe the first Thanksgiving, going back a few hundred years, were cranberries being cultivated as they are today, or were they being gathered? When did we start to get actual cranberry cultivation as we know it today?
So cultivation, in terms of not just going out and gathering the wild cranberries, began 200 years ago on Cape Cod, when Captain Henry Hall discovered that the sand that blew across his wild cranberries in his yard actually caused them to grow better. And so he brought cranberries under cultivation by adding thin layers of sand, and the industry began.
Now, who started the Cranberry Experiment Station, and what was the impetus for that? I mean, that was about 100 years ago, right?
Yeah, so about 100 years ago, there was a graduate student named Henry Franklin, who was working with entomologist named Fernald from what was then Mass Aggie. And he had come down to Cape Cod to survey the insects on cranberry bogs. And when that information was shared with the growers, they were so excited about this idea that somebody would bring science to their crop that they were inspired to want more of that. And so they petitioned the legislature to buy a cranberry bog in Wareham, Massachusetts, as an experiment site. And then they assessed their own members, one penny per barrel, which is 100 pounds, to raise the funds to hire a scientist to work at what became the Cranberry Station. And that scientist was Henry Franklin.
Now, it's interesting. I mean, if you think about that kind of arrangement these days, that researcher could be accused of being an industry shill, right? That they were paid for by the industry that they're trying to help. But it seems like that was kind of a common thing going on around that time. We had the Fisheries Service getting started right around 1900. A lot closer ties, maybe, between science and industry.
And that's true. And to some extent, it's being brought back a bit. There's a program at USDA called Specialty Crop Grants. And the whole point of this program is to bring farmers together to identify what their problems are and then to form a grant program based on that. And then researchers can come in and apply for money to deal with these problems. And so it's kind of come around full circle. And this is something that the Extension Service has done all along, is interact with farmers, find out what their problems are, and then bring them back to the universities to research solutions.
I mean, you've been at the Cranberry Station 33 years now. What first got you interested in cranberries?
Well, it was a bit of the family business. My grandfather built a cranberry bog in the 1950s, so it's been in the family. And then my dad, when he came back from serving in World War II, got a degree at UMass Amherst and ended up getting a position at the Cranberry Station as a lab technician before I was born. And he ended up making his career there for 45 years. So I was around the station my whole life. I've been around cranberries my whole life. Figured I'd go off and do something different, but in the end ended up coming back to where I started and realizing that what I get really excited about in science is using it to solve real-world problems.
How much has cranberry cultivation, the process, and also the market situation changed in the time that you've been at the station?
Well, The production of cranberries has advanced, has become more science-driven. We use science now and understanding, for example, of the life cycles of pests to know how to manage them better.
And are cranberries particularly pest-prone?
They are, like many crops. Also, because they evolved here, the pests kind of evolved along with them. And so there are a couple of key insects. There are actually 25 insect pests that we've identified, but there's one or two of them that are problematic for pretty much everybody. And then there are diseases and, of course, weeds that get in among the plants as well that can affect production.
I mean, we see poison. I live a couple blocks from some bogs, and we see poison ivy just rampant out in the middle of the bog.
Yeah, poison ivy is a huge problem. As you can imagine, nobody wants to hand weed it. And when it grows in the cranberry bog, it's not really its favorite environment. And so it grows poorly, which is a problem because it's right down in among the cranberry plants.
I mean, I didn't realize poison ivy had a preferred environment. I thought it just was everywhere.
Well, it does better in some places than others. So in the woods, you'll see these big, robust vines that climb right up the trees.
Oh, yeah, they look like small trees.
Exactly. And on the cranberry vines, they're more obscure, small, 2 or 3 inches tall plants, which is a problem because now they're right in among the cranberry plant. So, you know, a taller weed, you might be able to, you know, use some kind of a mechanism to grab a hold of it and pull it out, or use some kind of a chemical treatment. But because they're right down in with the cranberries, it makes it a huge challenge.
Okay, a little bit of news you can use, because like I said, I live right next to these cranberry bogs. I always go down after they've harvested, and we gather up like 5-gallon buckets full of the cranberries that are left right along the edges that are left behind. And I've had some friends go, oh, but aren't you worried about getting poison ivy? Like if there's all that poison ivy growing in there, could the cranberries be carrying it?
Certainly, if you get out and touch directly things that have been in contact with the poison ivy, it can be problematic. The important thing at this time of year is the poison ivy plant is also a perennial plant like the cranberry, and it actually pulls a lot of those oils that cause the reaction back down into its root system by fall. So the leaves that are left behind are not as apt to cause poison ivy, and so they're not as apt to get on the berries.
And when, then diluted with all the water from flooding.
I mean,
I can say we've never had a problem. We've,
right,
you know,
so
rinsed the berries,
you have some dilution and some fact that the poison ivy is not as reactive at this time of year because most of the oils have gone back down into the root system.
Okay, sorry, I interrupted you. You were telling us what's changed in the past 30 years.
So one of the things that's changed a lot besides the tools we use for pest management and the knowledge that we use is water management. So back in my father's day and my grandfather's day, to irrigate a cranberry bog or to protect it from frost in the spring, from cold temperatures, they put a flood over the entire surface of the bog and covered the vines. Uses a lot of water, takes a lot of time. Really problematic for frost because you don't know too far ahead of time when you're going to have the cold conditions, and it takes a long time to put a flood in place. And so over the years, before I came to the station, there was an agricultural engineer that worked on figuring out how to use a sprinkler system to protect the plants from frost. So much less water volume, but still get the protection. And of course, you can turn it on right when it gets cold. That's evolved now to one of my colleagues working with growers on figuring out how to use that same system in a more intermittent way to use even less water and even less fuel for pumping the water and still achieve that same thing. So that's evolved over time. And now, as we're getting hotter summers, we're actually looking at how to use that same mechanism, the fact that water evaporates, to cool the plants using that same intermittent activation of a sprinkler system. So just that one aspect of, you know, water management has evolved through the time that I've been doing this.
How much of those changes and how much research in general is being driven by considerations regarding climate change?
Well, a certain amount of it. Certainly some of this interest in heat management is very much involved. The other thing is looking at ways to conserve water, because even though over the last span of 15 or 20 years, the local annual rainfall hasn't changed very much, it's now coming more episodically. So like we've had a long drought this summer, Some years we'll get, 10 or 12 inches of rain in May and then nothing until fall. And so the idea of working on water management in terms of storage capacity, conservation, and so forth to make sure you have the water when you need it is critical, because in Massachusetts, about 95% of the cranberries are harvested in water. And this year there was some question as to whether that would be able to happen. Fortunately, we got some rainfall in September and October, enough to carry the growers through.
Hmm. Now, is climate change, would you say, the biggest threat that faces cranberries at this point?
It's probably the biggest threat aside from just economics. You mentioned the fact that there's increasing cranberry production in the United States and Canada. And so currently the supply and demand in the market is a bit out of sync. And so that's driven somewhat lower prices.
So what's driving that expansion in growing, whether it's Wisconsin or Oregon or Canada, if there isn't the market demand for more cranberry products?
Well, you're talking about a plant that is a perennial plant. If you plant a cranberry bed, you're not going to get a crop for 3 or 4 years, probably not a full crop for 5 years. And so you get these cycles. In the 1980s, there was a bit of a shortage of cranberries, and it encouraged a lot of people to plant, and they somewhat overshot the mark.
So what were people asking for that created a shortage? Was it just...
At that time, it was the juice market. Hmm. And so that led to the one of the recent oversupply situations in the late 90s. That was resolved by the advent of the dried cranberries, the so-called craisins, or
yeah.
other brands of dried cranberries, became so popular that, again, there was a bit of a shortage. And so, again, there was another big round of planting. And once again, they've overshot it a bit. And so now, aside from looking for the next big product, there's also the idea that, of opening foreign markets.
Well, and we were talking about climate change. Growing cranberries in Quebec, would that have even been possible 20, 30, 50 years ago as part of that kind of a movement northward in cranberry cultivation?
I think it's less to do with climate change and more to do with finding an area where there's a good land base that's suitable, acidic soils, plenty of water. Most of the cranberry region of Quebec is not that much different from Wisconsin, where we know we can grow cranberries. The Canadian government also supported the idea of bringing a more robust cranberry industry to Canada.
Hmm. And why is production in Massachusetts down relative to those other areas?
So it's not so much that our production is down, is that it's stable and other areas are growing. So Massachusetts' land base, we're a fairly urbanized environment. And so there's not a lot of room for new planting. And so the number of acres in Massachusetts has remained stable at around 14,000 acres of cranberries. Another difference is that a region like Wisconsin has not only expanded the number of acres, but they've done something that we call renovating or removing the plants and putting in new plants. At a faster pace than Massachusetts has. And when they put in the new plants, they put in higher yielding types, hybrid cultivars. And so in Wisconsin, the so-called heirloom or original cultivar cranberries makes up about 7% of their acreage. In Massachusetts, we have about 50% of our acreage in heirloom varieties.
Kind of an artisanal product here.
Exactly. And these are the iconic cranberries. They have that small, round, or oval shape that consumers around here are used to seeing in packages at the grocery market. Some of the newer cultivars are much larger. The berry's about twice the size. They're much rounder. And so, I've had people look at them and say, what are those, cherries?
Wow, that big?
Yeah, like a small cherry. But they don't have that kind of cranberry shape that people are used to, that's a little bit oval.
What are some of the really pressing areas of research going forward?
So anything to do with water, water quantity, water quality, preserving water quality, those are all big. And then pest management is always with us as we try to find more and more safe ways to manage pests.
Yeah, we've seen the rise of organic and a little bit of pushback from some cranberry farmers here on the Cape, saying it's just too hard to do that.
Well, part of the problem is what I mentioned before. We have this very well-developed pest complex. And so there are some tools that organic farmers can use to grow organic cranberries and manage those pests, but generally the outcome is a smaller crop compared to the non-organic segment. And, you know, 15, 20 years ago, that was okay because you were bringing in such a premium price for organic fruit that it overcame the fact that you had a small crop. Now, with the opening of areas like Quebec that are non-traditional and don't have those pest complexes, they can grow organic fruit at a much higher yield per acre and at much lower cost. And so they are basically scooping the organic market.
Okay, so you get your hands on some heirloom Cape Cod cranberries. We've got about a minute here. What's your favorite thing to do with them that we could add to our Thanksgiving table?
Well, I think the easiest thing is to make some kind of a sauce or a chutney. It's amazing how simple it is to make your own. Not to say that, you know, the jellied log isn't an icon of the Thanksgiving table, but, you know, there's so much you can do. If you like a sweeter thing, you can add apples with your cranberries. And basically, you throw the cranberries in a pot with a little bit of water or a little bit of orange juice or apple juice, and you just simmer them until the berries start to pop and it thickens up, and you have a whole cranberry sauce. And now you can put whatever you like in it. I like a little cardamom on a sweet one. Or if you're going in a savory direction, you could put a few onions or some jalapenos, curry spices, whatever's the flavor your family likes. But it's a really simple thing to do.
Carolyn D. Moranville is the director of the Cranberry Experiment Station, UMass Amherst, where she has worked for 33 years. She's planning to retire early next year. Carolyn, thanks very much. I hope you have a delicious Thanksgiving dinner and happy retirement.
Thank you very much, and happy Thanksgiving to you as well.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab is produced by Heather Goldstone and Elsa Partan. Mindy Todd is the executive producer. Major support for Living Lab comes from the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet.